laboratory were in chemistry and physics. Darwin has shown us the way, although he himself cannot see past the end of his nose. I have heard it is a rather long nose, but not long enough to see the truth. We shall go where Darwin never imagined. Transmutation, not natural selection, is the agent of evolution. God is an alchemist, not a plodding incrementalist like Signore Darwin. We shall show the scientific community, shall we not, my friend and colleague? Only those who dare much are capable of changing history and shining the light of knowledge on our dark world. I'm pleased to report that my Beatrice is flourishing. After a series of initial setbacks, due, I think, to incorrect dosage, she is as healthy as a weed, although I admit that I had a fright several months ago and almost lost her. But she recovered, and I have never seen a child look more radiant. How joyfully she plays in the garden! I have decided that botany is the most appropriate area of study for her, and I believe she has a naturally scientific mind, although in the feminine mode, of course. She cannot look at the plants as dispassionately as I do, but thinks of them almost as her sisters. She is sad that she cannot enjoy the insects, particularly the butterflies, but they perish from her breath. Our colleague Moreau was right to conjecture that the female brain would be more malleable and responsive to our experiments. I am fascinated by his research, but it seems as though he is never satisfied and must continually try new techniques with new experimental material. How I lament the scientific ignorance that hounded him out of your England. What he could have done with the resources and funding of a medical school. However, he is sending Montgomery to present a paper at the meeting of the Société in Vienna next month. Will you be attending as well? I look forward to hearing about your own experiments in transmutation, although I fear, dear colleague, that what you are undertaking is too dangerous. A scientist should not experiment on himself. He should be a dispassionate observer. And for an experimental subject, young, malleable flesh is best. You have a daughter, have you not? Surely she is old enough for you to begin the process in whatever direction you decide will yield the most promising results. Do please let me know if you will indeed be presenting a paper in Vienna. I'm getting old, but will brave the roads to see you. My very best regards. Giacomo Rappaccini.
I don't understand, said Diana.
Well, I don't either, said Mary, looking once again at the envelope. Dr. Giacomo Rappaccini, with a return address in Padua. That's not S.A. There's no seal on this envelope. You can see the circle where it was and a little bit of red wax, but it must have fallen off when the envelope was opened. And all this about Darwin and transmutation and their scientific experiments, although it does suggest that a theory of mine may be correct. She sat silent for a moment, looking at the letter in front of her.
Well, said Diana.
She waited, then stood and walked over to the sideboard, where she piled the rest of the sandwiches onto a plate. She poured herself a cup of tea, put in 4 lumps of sugar, then carried the plate and saucer with the cup balanced precariously on it back to the sofa. She set them down on the floor and sat on the sofa with her legs crossed under her, drawn up into the nightgown.
Are you going to explain your theory or not?
Reluctantly, Mary told her what she had told Mrs. Poole earlier that evening, about the possibility of a chemical transformation, the possibility she did not want to admit, that her father was indeed Hyde. After all, wasn't that transmutation? The transformation from a respectable gentleman to a suspected murderer. Look for yourself, she said, showing Diana the laboratory notebook, flipping to the relevant pages.
Well, that's it then, said Diana through a mouthful of bread and paste. I told you, didn't I? Sister.
It's not that simple,
said Mary. I don't know if that's the experiment this letter describes. Perhaps the notebook refers to something quite different.
He has gained the power to transform at will, and I cannot stop him, said Diana,
tapping the page with her finger and leaving a smear of paste.
That's plain enough, isn't it? He let out Hyde, and Hyde was taking over. You just don't want to believe your father was a murderer.
Of course not, said Mary, rubbing the paste off as best she could, although a grease stain remained on the paper. How do you feel, knowing yours is?
I don't know yet, said Diana. He's a suspected murderer, as far as I know. But I always thought he was a bloody bastard. Look at the way he abandoned my mother. She died in St. Bartholomew's, where they dumped her in a grave with the patients who had died that week so they could prepare her bed for someone else. I've never had your high opinion of our father.
You shouldn't say that, even if it's true, said Mary. We should not judge until we understand what happened. All this about Darwin and Moreau, that's another scientist I'm guessing, like Dr. Rappaccini, and these experiments. Diana snorted.
I don't care who they are. Bastards, the lot of them, most likely.
The door opened.
Miss Mary, do you need anything else? Have you actually eaten any of those sandwiches, or has that scamp eaten them all?
I don't think I can eat right now, Mrs. Poole, said Mary, putting a hand to her head and running it through her hair. Do you know why my mother saved these documents?
Perhaps she wanted you to have them, said Diana.
She started on her third sandwich.
While it pains me to agree with Miss Diana, and you are not to eat all the sandwiches no matter what Miss Mary says, she may be right. Mr. Utterson burned your father's papers after his death. Perhaps your mother saved these so you could read them some day.
I always wondered why she went mad. Mary might as well say it. Because that was what had happened, hadn't it? This, her husband turning into a monster. Well, it would explain a lot of things. Mary ran her fingers through her hair again, then tried to pin back the strands that were starting to come out of the bun at the nape of her neck.
That's terrible, miss, said Mrs. Poole. This letter is from Italy, from a Dr. Rappaccini.
Have you heard that name before, Mrs. Poole?
I believe he corresponded with my father regularly.
Mrs. Poole wrinkled her forehead.
I have heard that name before. The question is, where?
She was silent for a moment.
Wait, I seem to remember. It's in the kitchen. I'll be back in a moment.
She left the door open behind her. Mary and Diana stared at each other.
The kitchen?
Diana shrugged. In a few minutes, Mrs. Poole was back with a copy of the Gazette in her hand.
Here it is, she said triumphantly. Goodness, it's dark in here. Why haven't you turned on the gas? I'll do it, and then I'll be able to see. Yes, that's better. Beatrice Rappaccini, the beauty who breathes poison. Appearing 10 a.m. and 12 noon, Wednesdays and Fridays at the Royal College of Surgeons. Admission free with advertisement for all who would like to witness this scientific marvel. Otherwise a shilling for adults and sixpence for children. I was going to ask for Friday off, to see her.
Breathes poison, said Diana appreciatively.
Wish I could do that.
Beatrice Rappaccini, said Mary. Wasn't that the name in the letter? Mrs. Poole, you're right. I should have something to eat. Of course you can have Friday off. You can have any day off you like. But Diana and I are going to see her tomorrow, 10 a.m. sharp. We can get there and back by noon when we have an appointment with Mr. Holmes and Dr. Watson.
He's got a thing for you, said Diana, grinning.
He most certainly does not, said Mary indignantly.
Then why did he hand you out of the cab so carefully, Miss Jekyll?
Oh, you mean Dr. Watson? Well, I don't think he does either. Give me a sandwich. You've taken all of them. You're like a goose, you know that. They'll eat and eat until they're sick.
Mary took a sandwich off Diana's plate and bit into it. Paste, not her favourite, but it would have to do. Suddenly she realised that she was very hungry.
Mrs. Poole, can you pour me another cup of tea and then one for yourself? I think we're going to be awake for a while yet. I know you have to wash the dishes and sweep the floor and bank the oven, but for goodness sake, sit down for a moment and listen. I know you would never ask, but I want to tell you what happened today.
With visible reluctance, Mrs. Poole sat in one of the armchairs by the fireplace and clasped her hands on her lap, waiting. Mary recounted as succinctly as she could the events of the day, from the moment she had knocked on the door of 221B Baker Street to the moment Watson had deposited them once again at 11 Park Terrace.
Diana. And wasn't she properly horrified that her Miss Mary had gone gallivanting around London like that? I still remember how she looked at you.
Mary.
I do too, but you didn't say anything, Mrs. Poole.
Mrs. Poole.
Not my place, miss. You young ladies will do as you wish, whatever I think, and however foolish it may be.
So you see, Mary continued, showing Mrs. Poole the letter, my father was a scientist. He was involved in a series of experiments, and not just him, there were others as well, this Rappaccini and a Moreau.
And don't forget Darwin, said Diana.
Oh, for goodness sake, said Mary.
Don't you know who Mr. Darwin is? Did they teach you nothing at St. Mary Magdalene?
No, never mind, I'll explain later. The issue is they were involved in a series of experiments, and somehow my father learned to transform himself into Hyde. As Hyde, he murdered Sir Danvers Carew. I thought perhaps Hyde could be the murderer of Molly Keane, but that seems impossible now. If he was my father, then Hyde is dead, and there is no connection between the two murders, except this. She pointed to the seals on the two envelopes.
So what do we do now? Asked Diana. Look for S.A.?
Yes, although at the moment we have no idea what S.A. means. Why was my father receiving letters in Latin from S.A.? Did it have anything to do with his scientific experiments? Tomorrow we'll talk to this Beatrice Rappaccini. Tonight, Diana, I want you to tell us anything else you know about Hyde.
Mary sat back. She and Mrs. Poole looked at Diana expectantly. Chapter 6. Diana's Story. Diana stared at Mary and Mrs. Poole.
How would I know anything about Hyde? I mean, Dad. He died before I was born.
But your mother told you about him, said Mary. She told you about his connection with my father, didn't she?
What else did she tell you?
Think back. Anything you remember could be important.
Oh, hell, said Diana.
She shoved the rest of the sandwich into her mouth and finished her tea. Then she leaned back on the sofa and said,
She told me he was a proper gentleman, with an account at the Bank of England, and he had a house in Soho, furnished like a gentleman's house, with paintings on the walls. And he frightened her toward the end. He was always talking about life and death, about how the dead could be brought back to life. She thought he might be into spiritualism.
How the dead could be brought back to life? Said Mary. Do you mean ghosts or corpses?
How should I know?
Diana looked down at the plate on the floor, but it had no more sandwiches on it.
Corpses, I think. Yes, he told her that with the right chemicals, corpses could be brought back to life, if they weren't long dead, that is. He told her someone had done it with frogs.
Frogs? Said Mrs. Poole.
That's ungodly, that is. Why would anyone want to bring a dead frog back to life? Said Diana. I'm still hungry.
Are we done yet?
Oh, for goodness sake, said Mary.
Diana, this is important. Go back to the beginning. And I really mean the beginning. Tell me everything you know.
Diana, why do I have to write this part of the story? You're the author. Write it yourself like you're writing everything else and then say I wrote it. Isn't that what authors do?
Catherine, because this is what we agreed on. You would each write your individual stories and I would make them sound right. I would fit them into the whole so they made sense.
Diana,
well, why do I have to go first? Let Mary go first.
Catherine, because the whole story is Mary's story. She doesn't need to write a separate section, but you do. So sit down at that desk and write, and don't get up every 5 minutes to argue with me. The sooner you start, the sooner you'll finish.
Diana,
don't expect me to do all the he said, she said, and those fancy descriptions.
Catherine, write it however you want to, but start writing.
My mother was the long-lost queen of Bohemia. When she was a baby, she was stolen out of her cradle by a priest in league with her wicked uncle, who was attempting to usurp the throne. He had become regent after his brother's untimely and suspicious death. He thought that with the rightful, although infantine, ruler out of the way, he could crown himself king. The priest spirited her out of the castle by night, and then his confederates, who were also priests because we know that all priests are liars, carried her over the border into whatever country borders Bohemia. Where is Bohemia, anyway? They travelled by carriage and ship, eventually arriving in England, where they sold her to a poor family.
Catherine, Diana, if you don't start over again and tell the truth, I'm going to bite you.
Diana,
I'd like to see you try.
Mary, do you really want to tempt her? This is Catherine we're talking about.
Catherine, and write the way you speak. That sounds like one of your horrible penny dreadfuls.
Diana,
oh, all right. Though they're no worse than the books you write. Ouch! All right, you didn't need to do that. My mum never told me much about herself. Although she always said she was a Londoner through and through, born with the sound of the ships going up and down the Thames in her ears. That was her lullaby, she said. She would have been a kitchen maid, most likely, if she hadn't fallen in with a soldier when she was 15. It was a mistake, the greatest mistake of her life, she told me. But I've never regretted it, sweetheart, she would say. No, I've never regretted my Bonnie Joe. That's what they called him in the regiment. He was a Scotsman from Glasgow, and as handsome, she said, as the day was long. Well, there she was, 15 and with child, and her father cast her out of the house, telling her to go sleep under the bridges with the other whores where she belonged. And go sleep under the bridges she did, until she lost the child from hunger and illness. It was a boy. And I always wondered, when I was sent to sit on a stool or had my hands wrapped at St. Mary Magdalene, what my life would have been like if I'd had an older brother. But she was young and pretty, with a saucy tongue and long red hair from her Irish mother. So one of the houses by the docks took her in and paid her regular. And that was where she met my father, Edward Hyde.
Diana,
now don't you tell me I sound like a penny dreadful, because it's the literal truth.
Tell us everything you remember, said Mary, leaning forward.
It's a sordid enough tale, said Mrs. Poole.
But she too leaned forward eagerly to hear it.
Mrs. Poole, I did no such thing.
Diana,
if she interrupts me, I don't care who bites me. I'm stopping right here.
Mary, Mrs. Poole, could you please...
Mrs. Poole, oh, I'll go. I have no desire to read anything Diana writes about me. You are incorrigible, my girl.
Diana.
Of course I am, and the sooner you realise it, the better. It was run by Mrs. Barstow, and it was described in the Gentleman's Guide to London as a superior place, catering principally to doctors, lawyers and politicians. Barstow's had a reputation. It wouldn't service men in trade,
no matter how much money they had to spend. The girls were clean and could talk about the latest news. Mrs. Barstow made them read The Times, The Financial Times, and Punch. My father took a particular fancy to Mum. At first he tried a few of the other girls, but then he started asking for her regular. Maybe it was because he liked it rough and she didn't mind. She said he never hurt her. And he was ugly as sin, but she didn't mind that either. No man had meant anything to her since Bonnie Joe left with his regiment. She had told Joe about the child, and he had told her that he had a wife and three children already back in Glasgow with another on the way. "I can't do anything for you, my love," he told her, "but give you my blessing." And still she loved him and only spoke well of him to her dying day. Love is a fool's game, I think. One day Hyde said to her that he wanted a child, and if she had a child for him, he would take it and support it. Well, she didn't want that, although he offered her a lot of money. She had her living to get, and she was done with trusting men's promises. Catherine, she told you all this when you were just a child? Diana, she told me when she got sick, before they sent her to the hospital. I think she knew she wasn't coming back. Sweetheart, she said, I ain't been the best mum to you, but this is a hard world, and I want you to know what people are like, men especially. They will lie to you as easy as blowing dandelion clocks, and that's the best of them. She told me so I would know, and she was right.
Beatrice, she told you because she loved you. I wish I could remember my mother, but she died when I was so young.
Catherine, could we not dwell on the subject of mothers, please? Well, she found herself pregnant, and she thought he might have tampered with the protection she used. All the girls at Barstow's used protection against the clap. Though he was an ugly gentleman, he was a clever one, she used to tell me. He was a scientist, and we'd talk about the strangest things, like those experiments with frogs, raising things from the dead and turning things into gold, like that. She used to laugh at some of his ideas. Well, when he found out she was pregnant, he said he would support her and the child, and he put her in that house in Soho. He told her he hoped it would be a girl. She was surprised, because gentlemen usually want a boy. But no, he was particular, and said if it was a girl, he would be most pleased. And then one day, she heard a knocking at the door. She wondered who it could be, because no one ever visited that house. Hyde had no friends. She opened the door, and who should it be but the police? They said he was wanted for murder, and would she know where to find him? No, she told them. They asked her if they could come in and look around. Certainly, she said. So they looked around, and they questioned her again, and the housekeeper who lived with them. After a couple of hours they left, knowing no more than when they had come. She thought he would show up after a while, that he had gotten himself in trouble and was hiding, but would eventually return. He never did. She stayed until the end of the lease, then sold the furniture and moved to cheap accommodations in Spitalfields, and that's where I was born. We damn near died of hunger, although she worked hard enough, walking out with gentlemen while the butcher's wife minded me. But the windows were cracked and the wind blew in, and we had scarcely a blanket between us, with nothing to eat most nights. I was so hungry I would have eaten the rats if I could have caught them.
To think that you were born in such a place, said Mrs. Poole.
Suddenly, her heart swelled with pity for the poor orphan child, and she regretted her earlier harshness.
Mary,
it's a good thing Mrs. Poole is sorting laundry or whatever she's doing. I don't want to hear what she would say to that.
Diana,
how do you know her heart didn't swell with pity? Mrs. Poole can say what she likes, but she always gives me the largest chop and the most pudding.
Catherine, that's because you're so scrawny.
Diana, how do you know? Wouldn't it be rich if our precious Mary wasn't her favourite after all?
Mary, for goodness sake, can you just finish your section?
Diana,
You were the one who interrupted in the first place.
Yes, said Mary, also feeling a surge of pity for her long-lost sister.
Mary, oh, please.
One day, continued Diana, Mum ran into a friend from Barstow's who promised to speak for her, and Mrs. Barstow agreed to take her back, although she usually turned away girls who'd been foolish enough to get with child. I was 4 or 5 then. The girls would take care of me while Mum was working. They all liked to play with me. They were still children themselves. The youngest girls at Barstow's were 14. Mrs. Barstow wouldn't take them younger. I have standards, I do, she used to tell us. They sang to me and told me stories and made me clothes out of their cast-offs, decorated with bits of ribbon and lace that gentlemen had given them. As I grew older, they taught me games and rhymes, and even my letters. I learned about the world. There's no place in it for girls whose parents aren't rich and respectable, or who have Lascar blood in them, or who are addicted to laudanum. One step off the path of respectability and that's where you end up, Barstow's. It was a happy enough life for me, though maybe not for the girls there, until Mum became ill. One day she started coughing, and she just kept doing it until blood started coming up. Mrs. Barstow called the doctor and paid for the medicine herself, but finally Mum was too sick and had to go to St. Bartholomew's. That was where she died, in one of the common wards with their long rows of beds. The girls took me to visit, but several days later they told me she was gone. Mrs. Barstow herself held my hand as I watched her being lowered into the ground in the graveyard next to the hospital. She was wrapped in a shroud, and all I could see of her was her hair hanging out, like blood on the ground. I'll never forget the sight of it, or the stench of the corpses. I was only 7, but the girls talked to Mrs. Barstow and she decided I could stay, if each girl gave up enough of her pay to support me until I was old enough to support myself. All the girls agreed, though they had little enough themselves. They called me their mascot and said I would bring them luck. A week later, Mrs. Barstow called me into her parlour and said, "There's a gentleman here to see you on behalf of your father, Diana."
"A gentleman?" said Mary. "I thought it was my mother who took you from that place, Mrs. Barstow's, to St. Mary Magdalene. Although how could she have known that Hyde had a child?"
"Mrs. Poole, I think my mother had her secrets as well."
"Always trying to keep your father's secrets, like as not," said the housekeeper.
"I never saw your mum or any other woman," said Diana. "All I saw was a man in a frock coat and top hat. He said he was a lawyer who'd been sent to take me away from Mrs. Barstow's to a place where I would be educated and cared for. Well, little did I know that it would be Our Lady of Dullness. If I had, I would have kicked and screamed before letting him take me. But I thought he was going to take me to my father, and Mum had always told me he was a rich man. So I went with him. And did I ever regret it? The girls at Barstow's had let me wear their dresses and jewellery and put rouge on my cheeks and perfume on my wrists. They laughed and sworn and gotten drunk. At St. Mary Magdalene's I had to wear a grey dress with a white pinafore. My hair had to be up in braids and under a cap so it was proper. How they pulled it, braiding it in the mornings. There were no more bonbons, no more magazines with pictures. Just prayers and sewing. I swore under my breath and tangled the thread just to make the sisters mad."
"But what about this man?" said Mary. "Do you remember his name?"
"He never gave a name, at least not to me," said Diana.
"Was he short and crooked like Hyde?" asked Mrs. Poole.
"No. He was tall and straight, like a lamppost. He had sharp eyes that looked me up and down, and thin lips that he pressed together with disapproval when he saw how I was dressed. He carried a cane with a dog's head in silver as the handle. I kept looking at it because it was so lifelike. I wished it would bark."
"Mr. Utterson,"
said Mary.
Mrs. Poole, I'm completely mystified. Why would Mr. Utterson have been involved in this affair?
Well, he was your mother's solicitor at the time, said Mrs. Poole. Could he not have made all those arrangements for her? The documents, the account, even the child?
You're talking about me as though I'm invisible, said Diana,
once again pushing her big toe into the hole in the sofa and giving it a good tear.
But Mr. Guest didn't know about any of those arrangements, said Mary. Why would Mr. Utterson not have informed his own clerk?
Perhaps Mr. Utterson didn't trust him, said Mrs. Poole. Would you?
Not as far as I could throw him, said Mary.
Diana, have I done the he said, she said enough now? I'm getting tired of this.
Catherine,
oh, all right. I'll finish it up for you and revise what you've written to make it sound like a proper narrative, and to take out the cursing. Go do whatever it is you do.
Diana,
wouldn't you like to know?
Catherine,
not particularly.
Yes, her mother must have known. About her father and the experiments. About Hyde. Mary imagined Mr. Utterson, in his sombre frock coat and black top hat, with the gold chain of his pocket watch just visible, getting into a hansom cab and ordering it to take him to Barstow's. The cabbie must have grinned, to indicate that he understood what a gentleman such as Mr. Utterson would be doing there. It would have been so distasteful. And then arriving at the whorehouse, walking in and speaking to Mrs. Barstow herself, asking for the child, being presented with Diana, with her tangle of red hair, got up like a, well, like one of those girls. She could imagine him shuddering. He must have been acting for her mother. Mary had wondered how her mother, who was already ill, had managed to set up a bank account and bring Diana to the Magdalen Society. This explained it. The lawyer had done it all. And of course Mrs. Jekyll could not have gone to a whorehouse to pick up the daughter of her husband's assistant. Or, if Mary's hypothesis was correct, her husband's daughter by another woman. Mary put her head in her hands. This affair resembled a jigsaw puzzle. One corner of it was starting to fit together to show a picture, but there were so many other pieces that had no place as yet. Beatrice Rappaccini, the poor girl this morning with her brain cut out, and S.A., whatever that meant.
"So are there any more sandwiches?" asked Diana.
"Not for you," said Mrs. Poole. "I have a bit of jelly roll left, and that will be for Miss Mary because she's barely eaten anything. You've eaten quite enough, but that's the last of the sugar, I'm afraid."
"I'll go to the bank tomorrow and close the account Mr. Utterson opened," said Mary. "I didn't have time today, what with the corpse and long-lost sister and all." That will be the agenda for tomorrow, she thought, mentally making a list. If she could arrange it neatly in her head, then perhaps the events of the day wouldn't seem so bewildering. Clerkenwell, wherever that was, Bank of England to deposit the funds so they could buy sugar, Royal College of Surgeons to see the poisonous girl, back to Regent's Park to meet with Holmes and Watson. She wondered what Beatrice Rappaccini could tell them. Would she know what their fathers had been doing? What sorts of experiments they had been conducting? Would she know what S.A. stood for? Diana gave an enormous yawn.
"All right, to bed with you," said Mary.
One problem at a time, and the immediate problem was Diana.
Mary, as it so often is.
And then began the ordeal of getting Diana into bed, which involved several trips to the bathroom, innumerable glasses of water, and a headache for Mary, since Mrs. Poole declared early in the process that the heathen could stay up all night as far as she was concerned. Mary ended up giving Diana half of the jelly roll Mrs. Poole had brought up for her. Finally, the admonition,
"You say you're 14, but you behave like a child," had its effect. Diana lay tucked into bed in what had once been Mary's nursery, and Mary collapsed into a chair in her own bedroom. She was so tired. Once, her days had passed quietly, one after the other, in the routine of caring for her mother. She had ordered meals, responded to the nurse's complaints, paid bills. That once had been only a fortnight ago. In that fortnight, her life had changed completely, and she had the disquieting sense that it would continue to change, perhaps in ways that were not particularly pleasant. She had longed for adventure, and now that it was happening to her, she was not sure how she felt about it. Today she had been to Whitechapel, seen a corpse, and gained what was presumably a sister. What would tomorrow bring? The most difficult part, the part she did not want to think about quite yet, was the revolution a day had made in her memories of her father. The tall, kind, distant father she had known. At least he had not been a Dr. Rappaccini, experimenting on his own daughter. Or daughters, because there was, after all, Diana. Was Diana, in a sense, the product of his experiments? Why had Hyde wanted a child, and a girl specifically? Perhaps he had simply been jealous of his alter ego, and wanted a daughter of his own. If Dr. Jekyll had Mary, then he would have Diana. Or was there something more nefarious behind it? Those thoughts went around and around in Mary's head. Would it never stop aching? She should have asked Mrs. Poole for something. One of those patent medicines the housekeeper kept in her dispensary. But Mary did not want to wake her, or make a trip downstairs through the dark house. There was nothing to do now but get some sleep. She pulled on her nightgown and slipped between the covers. The nursery was next to her bedroom, and until she fell asleep, Mary could hear through the walls Diana snoring. It was a strangely comforting sound. The next morning Diana was up before she was. Mrs. Poole had dressed her in one of Mary's old dresses, which would have been given to Alice in another year. "Her own clothes will need to be washed," said Mrs. Poole, "though I don't know what good it will do. I've never seen dresses that have been mended so many times. They're about to come apart at the seams. And such cheap material, that scratchy grey wool. Thank goodness her coat is in a reasonably decent state, and I've made her polish her boots. But I've had to give her a pair of your gloves and one of your hats." After a breakfast of toast, eggs and coffee as a particular treat for Diana. "Coffee! Heavenly coffee!" Diana sang, dancing around the morning room. And Mary had to admit that she had a good singing voice. They walked first to the bank where Mrs. Jekyll had kept an account for Diana, and then to the Bank of England to transfer funds. £35, 5 shillings, 3 pence, in what was now Mary's own account. She withdrew a pound in change and put it into her purse. Oh, to have money in her purse again! Mrs. Poole would be able to buy sugar, and perhaps there would be jelly roll for tea. And then with Diana complaining that her boots pinched, they made their way to the Royal College of Surgeons to see the poisonous girl. Chapter 7. The Poisonous Girl. Mary and Diana crossed Lincoln's Inn Fields. Mary had never been in this part of the city. There were so many parts of the city she had never seen, although she had lived in London all her life. She sighed, remembering weeks when she had barely left the house, for fear that her mother might suffer another of her attacks. Thank goodness for Nurse Adams, who had been so reliable, although very expensive. But here she was, after a long walk from Threadneedle Street. Somehow she had expected Lincoln's Inn Fields to be Fields, but as so often in London, the name was deceptive. It was simply a park, surrounded by streets lined on two sides with respectable buildings in the Georgian style. On the other two sides were Lincoln's Inn, where barristers plied their trade, and the Royal College of Surgeons. As she and Diana walked through the park under a canopy of ancient oaks, Mary remembered the park she had seen yesterday in Whitechapel, with poor children playing in ragged clothes. How strange that the word park could describe such different places. The rain had stopped, but whenever the wind blew, which was often, large wet drops would fall on their heads from the branches above. Mary kept her umbrella up and tried to cover them both, but Diana always walked either ahead or behind her, not caring whether she got wet. As they left the park, they saw the facade of the Royal College of Surgeons with its grey columns, looming like a great mausoleum. There was already a line of visitors stretching down the stone steps. Mary could see respectable men in frock coats and bowler hats, mothers with children pulling at their hands and asking if they could go play in the park, maids on their day off, boys in dirty trousers who would obviously not be able to pay the entrance fee, but probably hoped to sneak in and catch a glimpse of the poisonous girl before they were ejected by the porters. She checked to make sure she had the advertisement with her, folded into her purse.
"Are you here to see the poisonous beauty?" asked a young man with a sparse attempt at a moustache, presumably one of the porters.
He had an official look about him and was holding a sheaf of pamphlets in his hand. When Mary nodded, he told her to line up behind the others. At 10 a.m. precisely, the line began to move. The visitors who had been waiting filed into the entrance hall, handing the porter either an advertisement or the requisite number of shillings and pence. In return, he handed them a pamphlet. Mary glanced at it quickly. At the top of the page was written, "The Poisonous Girl, a Wonder of Modern Science. Discovered by Professor Petronius, M.D., Doctor of Philosophy, member of the Anthropological Institute of Great Britain and Ireland." She did not have time to read the rest. The line was filing past a set of stairs marked "To Library," and through a pair of doors that opened into a large chamber. In the middle of the chamber was a wooden platform with a table on it. On the table was a collection of objects. Mary had no time to pay them closer attention, although she noticed that one was a canary in a cage.
"Now that's more like it," said Diana, turning and staring upward.
The chamber was two stories high, with a balcony running around it. On both the first and second floors, the walls were lined with wooden cabinets. Through their glass fronts, Mary could see anatomical specimens of various sorts, skeletons, but also row after row of glass jars, filled with what were presumably parts of the human body. It looked like the pantry of a frugal housewife, who instead of pickles, had put up hearts, livers, spleens. "Come on," she said to Diana, pulling her along by the collar. The audience to see the poisonous girl was a large one, and Mary wanted to get as close to the platform as possible. It was obviously the stage on which Beatrice Rappaccini would stand and do what? Mary had no idea. Would she simply be put on display? Like the freaks that were shown at the Royal Aquarium, the bearded women and dog-faced men. Mary had never seen one of the shows herself, but she had heard about them from servants. Alice, the scullery maid, had gone once with Mrs. Poole and could talk of nothing else for a week. She pushed through the crowd and secured a space for them at one corner of the platform, somewhat crushed between a woman in a violently purple walking suit and a man with a monocle. The woman gave her a look as Mary pushed her way in, as though she were some sort of recently discovered and unwelcome beetle. "Well," she told herself, "politeness has no place in a murder investigation." When the audience had been kept waiting just long enough to start getting restless, the porter said,
make way for Professor Petronius."
The crowd parted, and a man in a theatrical black
cloak, with enormous side whiskers too black to be entirely natural, walked to the platform. He looked around at the audience, clearing his throat once or twice, while the crowd quieted down and waited expectantly. Then he spoke in a voice that carried to the back of the room.
"Ladies and gentlemen, I am Professor Petronius. Welcome to this august institution, which has so generously allowed me to reveal to you one of the scientific wonders of our age, a marvel out of the classical world, when such a phenomenon was known, although it astonishes us to see it in the 19th century. Today I will show you a young woman, as beautiful and innocent as a rose in bloom, whose system has been so imbued with poisons that she herself has become poisonous to all she touches. Imagine, ladies and gentlemen, not being able to touch, to kiss other human beings for fear of harming them, of rendering them lifeless. Imagine being so deadly that your fellow men shun you once they learn of your powers. Today you shall see just such a creature, separated forever from others of her kind. She is not a monster, no, for unlike the elephant man or bear woman of whom you have no doubt heard, she was not born with her peculiarity. The poison was introduced into her system slowly over a period of many years, as you may read in my article, a copy of which you hold in your hands, originally published in the Journal of the Anthropological Institute. Beatrice Rappaccini is not a monster, but a marvel of modern science. Behold!
He flung out his right arm, pointing toward the entrance. There stood a woman about Mary's age, dressed in white. With the rest of the audience, Mary gasped. Even Diana, who was usually unimpressible, whistled under her breath. She was beautiful. She was, it was no exaggeration to say, the most beautiful woman most of the audience members had ever seen. Her dress was in the Grecian style, leaving her neck and arms bare. Her skin, of a soft olive hue, proclaimed her a daughter of the temperate south, and her cheeks were tinged with red, as though she had spent time under a southern sun. Her features were as clearly cut as those of an ancient statue. Her hair, a lustrous black, hung down to her waist. She stood still for a moment, then walked toward the platform, swaying as gracefully as one of the reeds so admired by the classical god Pan. Justine.
That's a lovely description, Catherine.
Catherine.
Thank you. I'm glad someone notices when I write particularly well.
Let her through, let her through, said Professor Petronius. Mothers, nurses, if you please, protect your children. Make certain they do not touch her, not even the hem of her gown. Remember that she is deadly.
The audience parted before her like the Red Sea, some of the mothers pulling their children back sharply as she passed, although the children strained to see her.
Poor girl, thought Mary.
Surely this Petronius is both cruel and a charlatan. She could not possibly harm those children. And indeed, as she moved through the crowd, the woman's face was so sad that Mary would have liked to comfort her.
Beatrice. Is that truly what you thought, when you first saw me?
Mary.
More or less, although you know how Catherine romanticizes everything. But I was thinking about how sad you looked.
Beatrice.
I was. Oh, indeed, I was so sad that you could not imagine the depth of my sadness.
The woman stepped onto the platform and stood beside Professor Petronius. She looked out at the audience, calmly and with an expression of resignation on her face.
"This charming creature," said Professor Petronius, "was born in the city of Padua, in Italy. No doubt even those of you who have not travelled in Europe have heard of the splendours of Italy.
The ruins of an ancient civilization turned up by every farmer's plough. The perpetual sun that warms the soul and makes it so much more eloquent than here in England. In Italy, the soul becomes poetic, although the body is lethargic. It is the country of Petrarch, of Michelangelo. That is the country in which Signorina Rappaccini was born.
Looking around at the stolidly English audience, Mary very much doubted that any of them had dreamed of travelling in Europe. A nice trip to Bournemouth would be more in their line.
Her father was a professor at the University of Padua, a famous doctor specializing in the vegetable poisons. He knew how to draw out their properties and turn the deadliest toxins into the most beneficial pharmacopoeia. His daughter tended his garden of poisonous plants, so she could tend them properly with the attention that the most delicate specimens required. He forbade her from protecting herself with gloves or masks. Slowly, as she assisted her father in his experiments, she herself became poisonous. The essence of the plants seeped into her, and as she grew into splendid womanhood, she also grew deadly to man. And now, said Professor Petronius, you shall see how deadly Miss Rappaccini can be.
From a vase on the table he lifted a Madonna lily, a long stem of white flowers, no doubt forced in a hothouse, since it was before the season for them. Ceremoniously he handed it to the woman, to Beatrice. She took it in her hand, held it for a moment, then opened her mouth and breathed on the flowers. Almost at once they began to turn brown, to shrivel and dry up. Their petals fell to the floor. Then the stem itself turned brown and was simply a dry stick. The audience gasped. In quick succession, as the audience stood spellbound, Professor Petronius handed Beatrice a variety of living objects. An apple on its branch rotted from her breath. Bees in a jar that had been buzzing a moment before fell silent and lay on the glass bottom, their wings twitching, and then still. A mouse, Professor Petronius handed her. Mary noticed that he donned gloves before doing so. Scampered up her arm, stopped on her shoulder, then stood as though transfixed. She lifted it off and kissed it tenderly before laying it back on the table, where it did not move. A small green snake that he lifted out of a box wound itself around her wrist. In a few minutes, she unwound it and returned its limp form. Finally, Professor Petronius held up the canary in its cage. Beatrice touched the cage gently with one hand. There were tears in her eyes as she leaned forward and breathed on the unfortunate bird. A moment before, it had been cheeping. It gave a final querulous cheep. Then it too was silent. Beatrice turned away, as though she did not want to see either the destruction she had caused or the reactions of the audience.
"Who will volunteer to approach and feel the power of Miss Rappaccini's breath?" asked Professor Petronius. "We need a robust gentleman who is willing to risk his life for a kiss from the poisonous beauty. Gentlemen, if you volunteer, Miss Rappaccini will kiss you on the cheek and you will feel her power. But do not volunteer if you have a heart condition, or your medical adviser has forbade you from taking vigorous exercise."
Mary was astonished to see that there were indeed volunteers. Professor Petronius chose two, a younger gentleman who was no doubt some sort of clerk, and an older man who proclaimed that he was a builder and not afraid of a girl. Both were given the opportunity to go up to Beatrice and hold her hands. Then she leaned over and kissed each of them on the cheek, quickly, and with no indication of enjoyment. When they turned back to the audience, the clerk looking dazed and the builder grinning, Mary could see the red mark of her lips on their skin.
"How do you feel, gentlemen?" asked Professor Petronius, according the builder a rank he did not deserve.
Both proclaimed that they felt dizzy.
"It's like being drunk, it is," said the builder. "Don't know as I could make my way home if I felt like this after leaving the pub on a Friday night." "You are brave, gentlemen," said Professor Petronius. "When you go home tonight, tell your wives or sisters or mothers that today you were kissed by death and survived. Those marks will fade in a few days, although I would recommend a topical ointment to assist with healing. Now, if anyone in the audience has questions about this marvel of science, I am available to answer them."
There were questions. What did Miss Rappaccini eat? How long would it take her to poison a full-grown man? Who did her hair? While Professor Petronius answered them, Mary slipped closer to where Beatrice stood on the platform. How could she communicate with the poisonous girl? There had been no indication that she spoke anything but Italian. Quickly, Mary drew a pencil from her purse. Did she have any paper? Yes, the pamphlet. She tore off a corner, scribbled on it the letters she had seen on the watch fob in Molly Keane's hand, and the seal on the mysterious letters from Budapest, and held it out, whispering as loudly as she dared, "Miss Rappaccini." Beatrice heard her and turned her head. For a moment, Mary was not certain whether she would take the note, but then she took a step toward Mary and held out her hand. Mary placed it on her palm. She could not help being glad that she, like Professor Petronius, was wearing gloves. How far did Miss Rappaccini's baleful influence extend? Beatrice glanced at the note. When she saw the letters, her expression changed. For the first time, she looked interested, alive. "What is your name?" she asked in a low voice. "Mary Jekyll," Mary replied. "Wait for me in the park," said Beatrice. "I will try to get away, although it will be difficult. He watches me all the time. But wait for me. I will be there when I can." It was obvious from Beatrice's furtive glance at Professor Petronius that she did not want to speak further in the exhibition hall. Mary nodded. Their conversation would have to wait. She looked around for Diana. Where had the girl gone? Mary assumed she had been standing beside her all this time, but no. Diana had slipped away and was on the far side of the room, staring at one of the glass cases. Mary pushed through the crowd, which was still questioning Professor Petronius. "Do you ever do as you're told?" she said to Diana when she had made her way to the case. "No," said Diana without turning. "Look, it's the skeleton of Charles Byrne, the Irish giant. 7 feet tall he was. And there's the brain of some kind of mathematical bloke. I've never seen a brain before." Mary glanced over. The jar was labelled, "Brain of Charles Babbage, Mathematician." "Diana, we don't have time to look at all these things, not right now." She told Diana about the note she had passed to the poisonous girl, and Beatrice's reaction. "We need to go wait in the park. That professor, I think she's afraid of him. She said that she had to get away from him to meet us. We need to go wait for her, so we're there when she has the opportunity." It was difficult to drag Diana away from such a tempting display of grotesquerie, of fetuses in jars, some of them with two heads or four arms or only one eye, of tumours and abnormalities. But Mary took a firm hold of her coat collar and pulled. "Diana, my favourite was Charles Byrne. I'd never seen a giant before." "Justine, he was not a giant, simply a very tall man. There is nothing wrong with being tall." "Diana,
says you. Of course you don't think it's abnormal, any more than Beatrice thinks it's abnormal to go around poisoning people."
"Beatrice, but I know perfectly well it's abnormal, I assure you. Justine's height is not extraordinary, for a man. For a woman, yes. But as she says, there is nothing wrong with being different."
"Diana, oh, come off it. You're both freaks, just like me."
Outside, the rain had started again. Not a proper rain,